Focusing on the 2-year-old little girl was Lonnie's way of numbing her own pain. We try to fix, ignore, or quickly forgive anything to move us out of the pain we're sitting in. The Greek word for trauma means to wound, damage, or defeat. It's ugly, messy, excruciating work. Much like patients in the ICU wing of a hospital, women experiencing betrayal trauma need to be greeted with compassion and offered an emotionally supportive gurney to rest upon. The phonetically spelled ICU sounds like I see you, and stabilizing a betrayed woman from the impact of betrayal needs to come first. What does she need to help her feel safe? How can truth be reestablished in the relationship? A full disclosure? Lie detector? Only after a woman is strengthened and steadied will I respectfully begin to unpack any relational traumas before the betrayal. You get the picture. Lonnie was gutted. She needed a tourniquet around the damage caused by her betrayal wound first. She wouldn't be able to catch her breath until she had it. Some of us unknowingly have open wounds from the past that get triggered and reopened in the present. I understand the complexity of layered trauma. Here are some of the things that happened to me while I was growing up. I was bullied. I was stalked. I was sexually betrayed. I was physically assaulted. My name was painted with sexual graffiti on my high school wall. My car was completely covered by green spray paint and profanity. I was held up at gunpoint in a bank robbery. I dealt with years of severe mental illness in my own family. All this happened before I was 27. It's the painful stuff you wouldn't wish on anyone. Shame sticking to us like rubber cement. The third layer of the iceberg holds the trauma-induced shame beliefs that become attached to us when we're wounded. These shame beliefs can stick to us like glue and drive how we think, believe, and act. These trauma-induced shame beliefs in the third layer can sound like, I'm not lovable. I'm not in control. I can't trust anyone. I'm powerless and helpless. I should have done something. I'm shameful and did something wrong. I need to be perfect and please everyone. Here are two of my shame beliefs and how they played themselves out over a 10-year period of time. It's not okay to feel or show my emotions. And I can't ask for what I need. As I opened the car door, I noticed the seat was slightly reclined. Connor had forgotten his wallet and had to run back into the house to get it. Something didn't feel right. I noticed a long black hair on my headrest. I was stunned. Maybe it was just a coincidence, a strand of hair from one of our volunteer staff. I started checking off women's faces in my mind. Connor came around the corner. I didn't know what to say. I was afraid. I swallowed that painful moment like a coyote eating rancid meat. I felt shame. What's wrong with me? What happened in that car seat? What is Connor hiding? Maybe I'm overreacting. I just wanted to run. You can see how my beliefs, it's not okay to feel or show my emotions, or I can't ask for what I need, kept me from sharing my fears with Connor or asking him about my discovery. I realized my beliefs could be traced back to high school. I had been dating someone I'll call Dale. It was just after midnight. I was dog-tired and glad to be done with my shift. I opened the screen door behind the restaurant where I worked and walked to my car. Dale jetted around the corner. I was startled to see him. I had broken up with him the day before. His face was expressionless. Something didn't feel right. My gut braced itself. As a star athlete, he was 240 pounds big, with an even bigger temper. In a fit of rage, he grabbed my car keys with one hand and ripped my sweater down the front with the other. Like an enraged grizzly bear, he threw me up against a brick wall. I was stunned. I can't remember if I screamed. Someone called the police, and within minutes a squad car sped around the corner. Dale jumped over the back fence and ran. I covered my exposed chest, got into my car, and left. I felt shame. I just wanted to leave. How was I going to explain this? It was my fault for leaving him. See again how my underlying shame beliefs and fear kept me from telling the officers what happened or filing a report. I grew up in a home where some painful things happened that no one talked about. Like a scene from The Wizard of Oz, my home was filled with flying monkeys. No one wanted to talk about them or even acknowledge the monkeys existed. Severe mental illness does that. It opens the door to fear, neglect, and all kinds of craziness. Something didn't feel right. It wasn't okay to tell anyone what was really going on. I felt shame. I learned how to ignore the obvious, muzzle my mouth, and live in silence. I swallowed it there, too. Stuck in shame. Trauma-induced shame beliefs, if left unchallenged, create havoc in our lives. Sometimes we get stuck and struggle with knowing how to connect with others. I didn't learn how to stand up for myself or ask for what I needed. I didn't believe I was worthy. I used to say, "I'm sorry, I'm sorry, I'm sorry," more often than not. I took responsibility for actions I didn't cause. Wires got crossed in my thinking, and I built a wall around my heart. Shame does that. It makes us feel bad about who we are. It's these trauma-induced shame beliefs that unconsciously drive what we do. While the goal of these negative beliefs is self-preservation, if left in the driver's seat, they undermine who we are by sapping our power, smothering our voice, and creating self-sabotaging ways of living. We may not even be aware of how traumatic events, like an iceberg submerged underwater, have impacted our thinking. Uncovering these negative shame beliefs can help us gain traction in our healing. Healthy thinking empowers us and keeps us from becoming helpless in harmful situations. When we know the right things to do and don't follow through, there just might be a trauma-induced shame belief under the surface that needs some deeper excavating. Deep wounds need deep healing. The fourth layer reveals how we attach to others based on whether or not we receive comfort and care while growing up. In their book, How We Love, Mylan and Kay Yurkovich have divided attachment into six relationship styles: secure, pleaser, vacillator, controller, victim, and avoider. While we'll be looking more deeply into relationship intimacy and attachment in the next chapter, unresolved memories and pain from the past influence how safe we feel connecting with others. The fifth and deepest core layer of the iceberg reflects early events, painful life-altering situations that have impacted us. They can be either our earliest memories of abuse or neglect while we were growing up, or the worst memories of its kind. Discovering these events and the resulting shame beliefs may shed some light on why we do the things we do. Wounds of omission are what you needed but didn't get, and wounds of commission are the things that happened to you that should never happen to anyone. Wounds of omission, what you needed but didn't get. You didn't have safe boundaries in your home. Your natural gifts and talents weren't cultivated. You weren't cherished, celebrated, or delighted in. You didn't receive safe, non-sexual, nurturing touch. You weren't taught to do hard things and problem solve. You didn't have a parent who took time to understand who you are. You weren't given adequate food, clothing, shelter, and/or medical care. Wounds of commission, what painfully happened to you? Verbal abuse, sexual abuse, physical abuse, emotional or psychological abuse, abandonment by a parent, bullying by siblings or others, witnessing someone being abused. These blow to our lives leave painful shame beliefs that can become embedded like shrapnel under our skin. In Chapter 7, we'll dig deeper into these early trauma events to help pinpoint how layered circumstances may be unknowingly influencing us. Complex trauma, the layers of shame that stick like glue. To further illustrate the iceberg analogy and how early trauma intermingles with betrayal trauma, let's take a look at Sharon. I tried hard to be a good wife. I did all the right things, and it happened anyway. My conclusion? I'm just not enough. Sharon. On the surface layer of the iceberg, Sharon loves her job as a hairstylist. She's been married to her husband, Devin, for 16 years. They met in high school, got pregnant, and then married. They have two sons and a daughter. Sharon manages hundreds of Facebook friends, coordinates after-school sports, fundraises for her daughter's cheerleading squad, and helps with the after-school tutoring program. Not only has Sharon been betrayed, but she's also living with the pain of unresolved relationship trauma. The second layer of the iceberg is the behaviors she and others might see. For years, Sharon has run on the fumes of exhaustion, making sure everything is done right. Sharon manages problems with a smile on her face. She gets 5 to 6 hours of sleep each night and complains she can't turn her mind off. Most nights she drinks a glass of wine before going to bed. Sharon struggles with pleasing others, perfectionism, control, excessive responsibility, intimacy issues, poor boundaries, self-medicating, and neglecting her own self-care. In Sharon's case of complex trauma, the third layer of the iceberg is twofold: her betrayal trauma with Devin, as well as traumas she's experienced before the infidelity. On the left are the trauma-induced shame beliefs Sharon has after discovering Devin's affairs. Sharon is devastated. When I asked Sharon what she believed about herself in light of Devin's betrayals, she chose these six beliefs to highlight her betrayal trauma. I'm not good enough. I'm not in control. I did something wrong. I'm not sexy enough. I can't trust anyone. I can't trust myself. On the right side of the third layer of the iceberg are the trauma-induced shame beliefs Sharon got while she was growing up. Her negative beliefs came from things that happened to her and from what she needed but didn't get in her family. Her childhood shame beliefs quietly fueled how she lived, even before knowing about Devin's betrayals. Her childhood trauma beliefs were, I'm not good enough. I'm not in control. I did something wrong. I'm not lovable. I'm insignificant. I don't matter. I need to be perfect and please everyone. These negative shame beliefs cluster together to make up Sharon's fourth layer of the iceberg, her pleaser attachment style. Because Sharon hates conflict and fears rejection, she does whatever it takes to fix a problem or to keep others happy. Later in our work together, Sharon made a connection between her father leaving and her fear of getting close. The more I gave myself to Devin, the more I worried he'd leave, or maybe I wouldn't be enough. Sharon regretted feeling exhausted and overcommitted. It seems like I'm trying to stay one step ahead of disappointing someone. I think I've been longing to be appreciated and seen. Between our kids and work, Devin and I have been running in our own circles. The very core of Sharon's iceberg is layer 5. It's where we uncover what happened to her. Sharon grew up in an alcoholic home. Her mother raged and often collapsed on the couch in a drunken stupor. Sharon remembers covering her mom with a polka dot blanket while smelling the fumes of alcohol seeping from her skin. When Sharon was 6 years old, her dad left for work one day and never came home. "Why did my dad leave me?" she wondered. Sharon did her best to be a good girl and has anxiously tried to fix patch and repair problems ever since. Her shame beliefs, "I did something wrong," and "I'm not good enough," became glued to her soul and fueled her behavior for years. Devin's affairs confirmed what Sharon already believed to be true. "I am simply not enough for any man to stay." The added layers of pain-filled shame fell onto her pre-existing wounds. Devin's porn use and affairs added the beliefs, "I can't trust anyone, and I can't trust myself." Sharon said, "Devin is the only man I ever trusted. He knew my story. How could I have missed this?" Somewhere along the way, Sharon started believing, "If I just keep everyone happy, they'll want me." She spent a lifetime trying to stay one step ahead of something she couldn't control, someone else's choice to love, leave, or deceive. As a natural reaction to growing up with an alcoholic mom and a dad who left, Sharon dealt with the trauma-induced shame beliefs, "I'm not good enough," and "I'm not lovable," keeping her at an arm's length from others. Without realizing it, Sharon built a self-protective wall around her heart. She feared vulnerability and struggled with emotional closeness, believing others would leave her if they really knew who she was. As though untangling a dump truck filled with long strands of snarled Christmas lights, we rolled up our sleeves and began to work. "I did something wrong" became, "I did the best I could with what I knew. I can learn from all this." "I can't trust anyone" became, "Trust is earned. I can choose whom to trust." "I'm not in control" became, "I can make choices today about what I need." "I can't trust myself" became, "I was duped." "I'm not good enough" became, "I am enough." Even though Devin and I both struggle with intimacy, it was his choice to betray. Sharon began to look at how her childhood wounds and shame beliefs blocked her closeness with others. "I used to think Devin and I were close because we did things together and went on vacations with the kids. Now I can see we really didn't talk about deeper stuff. We'd have daily data dumps about work or the kids, but neither of us knew how to talk about our feelings and what's really going on. I am so hurt right now, and I'm not sure how we're going to get through all of this. I think both of us have a fear of getting close. I just didn't see it before." Sharon became clear-minded. Devin's pornography use and affairs weren't her fault. It was Devin's choice to betray and her father's choice to leave. Neither was a result of her not being good enough. It's about what happened to you. When we look at trauma over your lifetime, it's not about you, it's about what happened to you. What happened to us shapes how we see ourselves and how we love. While looking for love, we can overfunction, underconnect, desperately throw ourselves on others, or build moats around our hearts. Even though those actions are not healthy, they're what we do when we've been hurt. Like Sharon, you may discover shame beliefs that have their roots in early childhood wounds. Or your trauma-induced shame beliefs may have started after you discovered the sexual betrayal. Either way, taking the time to soulfully unpack the traumatic events in your life, past or present, is important for your recovery's sake. Freedom is possible. I not only believe it's possible, I'm a walking billboard to prove it. In the next chapter, we'll be doing some deeper excavating to discover if any of these nagging shame beliefs may be unknowingly influencing you. Chapter 7, Digging Into Our Roots. We all want to be known by someone, really known. We want to be loved, warts and all. Connor and I dated long distance for 1 year and then got married. During that time, our relationship dripped like strands of honey, and our time apart was filled with the sweet expectation of seeing each other again. We kept the mailman busy with love letters going back and forth, and we had phone conversations that went till the wee hours of the morn. I felt pursued. Tension. Lovely, unadulterated tension. How could it ever be any different? We saw each other one weekend a month for 12 months. Those 2 days were filled with adventure, passion, family, and conversations about life and ministry. Connor and I told each other we were going to set this world on fire. More than 500 people cheered for us at our wedding. Our future was bulging with dreams, possibilities, and wonderful doses of fantasy. Connor's sexual betrayal caused both of us to start rummaging around our root system. On the surface, his family looked great. I grew up in a home where learning to stay out of reality was how I coped. Fantasy became my gig, and there was a lot more to cover up. My family roots had a long rap sheet. Grungy meets great, a compelling love story, one that defied all odds. It's what Academy Award-winning films and best-selling romance novels are made of. I was loved, but I wasn't known. What I didn't realize until later was that we were both in hiding with a case of mistaken identity. In our own way, each of us found relief when our family roots were covered under 20 feet of dirt. The fertile green leaves that grew on each other's trees captivated us. No shouts from the outside world could have told us differently. So why did I keep hearing this troublesome whisper in my head? A muffled voice kept telling me something wasn't quite right. I remember saying to the pastor who did our premarital counseling, "I don't know if Connor really needs me. I know he wants me, but something doesn't feel quite right. When I'm with Connor, it feels like I'm not allowed to get close to his heart." It was a few weeks before our wedding, and there was a lot at stake. The pastor dismissed my concerns as bridal jitters and something I shouldn't worry about. The pastor knew Connor's lineage and mine. I got that raised eyebrow and unspoken message. "Girl, don't mess up a good thing." I stuck a sock in my mouth, trusted his opinion, and worked to convince myself that my anxious musings were my fault. Like peering through fogged glass, I had a hunch something was missing. I felt it, but couldn't see it. I didn't even know its name. It was a fear of intimacy. Connor and I had intimacy issues. Intimacy is "into me you see." Connor and I hadn't dug into our family roots. We put our best foot forward and kicked the dirt over the parts of ourselves we didn't like. Oh, we talked about some tough stuff. But as with a TV remote, we put what we wanted seen on the big screen. Unknowingly, both of us were covering our shame. "I'm not good enough. You won't love me once you know me. And my needs won't be met if I have to rely on someone else." Blinded by our own shame, we fell in love. Deep inside, we feared rejection, so we covered our shame in secrets. We believed love conquers all. So when the highs and lows of life were mixed with sexual deception, we didn't have the tools or reserves to move through it. Intimacy and dishonesty don't mix. When sexual betrayal entered our relationship, trust was damaged and our relationship imploded. When our intimacy is starving, broken trust creates a rupture in any relationship. The longer Connor looked at porn and sexually acted out, the more disconnected we became. We couldn't work at rebuilding trust until Connor started getting honest about his sobriety. It appeared to me he didn't think his problem was that bad. Each time Connor sexually acted out, it felt like I went back to square one. It wasn't until years later that I discovered a term used to define a fear of closeness, intimacy avoidance. When one partner sexually acts out with others through porn and affairs, it puts a wedge between the spouses and destroys their ability to be close. You can't sexually act out with others and soulfully attach to your spouse at the same time. It sabotages intimacy and keeps the relationship from growing deeper. The AAA battery of intimacy. As I mentioned in the last chapter, Milan and Kay Yurkovich use their book, How We Love, to show how intimacy grows out of a healthy connection. They have divided attachment into six relationship styles: secure, pleaser, vacillator, controller, victim, and avoider. I believe Connor may have been an avoider, and I was a pleaser. Both of us had issues and struggled to connect. The concepts of attachment and attunement are necessary building blocks to intimacy. Attachment is often described as a strong bond or feeling of love for someone or something. Attunement is different and elicits a deeper layer of connection. Dr. Dan Siegel, who coined the term interpersonal neurobiology, uses the concept of feeling felt to describe how one person can authentically empathize and be emotionally present or attuned with someone else. Martin Buber introduced two ways we relate with others, I-it and I-thou. No human really wants to be an it. When we become objects or objectify others, it's dehumanizing and hurts. From the moment we're born, we long to be an I-thou. We want to be emotionally felt and hear, "You matter to me, I see you." We are made for love. Our first experiences of attachment begin with our primary caretaker between birth and 2 years of age. All of us ask ourselves two simple questions. One, am I lovable? Or two, can I count on others to be there when I really need them? When you think back to how you connected in your family, ask yourself these five questions. One, was my home a safe place to be? Two, when I was in distress, was I comforted? Three, were there shared moments of being noticed, delighted in, or needed? Four, how much time was devoted to connection and conversations in my home? Five, was there a reassuring voice, hug, or simple pat on the back when I needed it the most? How do you see yourself and your spouse answering these questions? Your answers may give you clues to how safe it was to be emotionally vulnerable, to trust, and to connect. How much comfort and attunement we receive while growing up sets the tone for how we love. While our family histories may clean up well, they can inadvertently cover pain and fears about connection. When breaches of trust are added into the mix, it only makes things worse. Couples suffering from ongoing betrayals feel like they're caught up in a horror flick. Hanky-panky collides with a bad dance of hokey-pokey, and sex addiction becomes a way of keeping one foot in and one foot out. Fears of intimacy often keep one partner holding the other at arm's length, making it impossible to fully engage in the marriage. Dr. John Gottman's research with betrayed couples found three necessary components to reviving trust: atone, attune, attach. To atone means to repair the injury and work towards restoring the wrong that's been done. A person can't attune or attach well if they haven't done what's needed to atone for the incredible pain caused by sexual deception. The betraying spouse bears the burden of that responsibility and can't fake this step. This empathic process takes time and can be incredibly challenging for both parties. The betrayed partner knows when restoration is sincere. It must be consistent and felt. We can't intimately connect without repairing the breach. 8 fears that block intimacy. My struggles with intimacy were layered. Not only was I dealing with sexual betrayals, but early childhood wounds caused intimacy fears as well. Whether our fears begin before or after the sexual betrayal, both are aimed at self-protection and unconsciously block connection. Beliefs like, I can't trust anyone, I should have known better, or I can't trust my judgment, keep our relational world in suspense. As I read through these 8 fears, think about if any of these intimacy challenges might ring true for you. Fear of dependency. We prize the idea of being self-reliant and independent. We see our neediness as a sign of weakness. Fear of emotions. Some of us are afraid of feeling or expressing our emotions. We keep our emotions in check and hide behind what we believe or think. Fear of loss. Avoiding grief and feelings of sadness often show up as nervous humor, flattened emotions, or numbing sad feelings with food, sex, shopping, gambling, etc. Fear of vulnerability. Sometimes we've been repeatedly or deeply hurt, and it's left us feeling defenseless and susceptible to harm. Anger can be used to keep others at arm's length through aggression, criticism, sarcasm, and rage. We might fight or avoid conflict as we struggle in knowing how to express what we need in a constructive way. Passive aggressiveness often becomes a way to avoid an undesired honest conversation or expressing vulnerable feelings like hurt, pain, or sadness. Fear of rejection. Vulnerability requires we openly share ourselves and our real experiences of abandonment, rejection, and betrayal keep us emotionally guarded when opportunities for closeness become available. Fear of being re-injured. Whether we've grown up with abuse or not, infidelity can leave us afraid to open our hearts to trust again. Even after our spouses have established long-term sobriety and continue to work towards protecting and restoring our trust, emotional distance may become a way we keep ourselves from being harmed again. Fear of helplessness. Painful things happen to us that turn our world upside down. We fear either losing control or being controlled. In order to keep our world safe, we manage connection with control and replace flexibility with fear. We need to take calculated risks and be willing to rebuild trust. Fear of letting go. Some individuals find it difficult to let go of their resentment and bitterness. It may feel like it dishonors the pain we've experienced if we let someone off the hook. While a protective wall of resentment and unforgiveness feels safe, it sabotages our ability to rebuild trust and love again. As a little girl, I learned relationships weren't predictable or safe. My marriage to Connor wasn't safe either. Most of my life was spent building a moat around my heart while adding flesh-eating alligators as needed. Intimacy issues grow out of what happened to us. I had to own my fears about how risky it felt to get close and trust again. And then I had to let other safe people comfort me, especially when I felt weak. To be honest, learning to let others take care of my needs was one of the hardest parts of my recovery. Dr. Bessel van der Kolk says, being able to feel safe with other people is probably the single most important aspect of mental health. Safe connections are fundamental to meaningful and satisfying lives. I spent a whole lot of years practicing with safe people in group settings and friendships to grow into what's called an earned secure attachment style. I feel like I should be wearing a purple heart of bravery for these earned secure stripes I now wear on my sleeve. I'm here to tell you it's possible to change, grow, and attach more intimately. While it goes without saying that sexual sobriety is a must, digging into our roots can help us and our spouses explore the underlying shame, beliefs, fears, and wounds that need to be addressed. Wounds of omission and commission. If recovering from sexual betrayal isn't enough, looking into our childhood wounds can feel daunting. Let's take a look and see how our childhood wounds can be broken down into two types. One, wounds of omission or shame of deprivation. These are the good things we needed but didn't get. Two, wounds of commission, inflicted shame, are the things that happened to us that shouldn't happen to anyone. Let me start by saying this. Sexual betrayal is an inflicted shame. A wound of commission comes through being harmed by someone else. You didn't deserve it, and it shouldn't happen to anyone. Even if you and your spouse were struggling with issues in your relationship, it's never an excuse for sexual infidelity. Both of you may have experienced wounds of commission and omission as children. Amid underlying shame beliefs and intimacy issues, sexual betrayal takes a marriage to a whole different level of pain. Trauma work and getting rid of underlying shame is a lot like removing cancer. You start where the cancer was first discovered and then move through the body with a fine-tooth comb looking for any other area where cancer cells might be growing. The goal is a clean bill of health, which can ultimately bring peace. It's not surprising that the ancient Hebrew word picture for shame, kalima, means what comes from all chaos, or that the Hebrew word for peace, shalom, carries with it two ideas, to destroy the authority that establishes chaos, and to deal with the root issues. Life is chaotic when shame drives how we think, feel, and live. Digging into our historical roots, including the betrayal trauma we've experienced, involves looking at the sources of our wounds so we can get unhooked from the shame. In Chapter 6, I introduced a survey I did with 100 women, all of whom experienced betrayal trauma. According to the Adverse Childhood Experiences Scale, 79% of the women surveyed reported experiencing at least one adverse childhood trauma, like emotional, physical, or sexual abuse, neglect, household challenges such as parental separation, divorce, and domestic violence. With those numbers in mind, let's take a look and see if any of these trauma-induced shame beliefs from early childhood sound familiar to you. What you needed but didn't get. First, let's take a look at the wounds of omission. These are the good and necessary things we needed but didn't get. The shame of deprivation is one of the quickest ways to feel less than human by not being seen, heard, or acknowledged, or maybe being flat out ignored. The overarching message is this: you don't matter. Imagine a graph. At the top, it says wounds of omission, the good things we needed but didn't get. On the left-hand side are trauma-induced shame beliefs. On the right-hand side are healthy, positive beliefs. I'll go through the list between trauma-induced shame beliefs and healthy, positive beliefs. Might sound something like this. I'm not lovable can be I'm lovable. I can't do that. I'm incapable can be I'm capable. I can learn new things. I don't need anyone, I'm fine on my own, can be, I can share myself with safe people. I'm different and don't belong, can be, I'm worthy of acceptance and belonging. I don't matter, I'm insignificant, can be, I can be seen, heard, and known, I matter. I can't ask for what I want or need. Can be, I have a voice, I can ask for what I need. I'm either too much or not enough. Can be, I'm okay as I am, deserving of connection. It's not okay to feel or show my emotions. Can be, I can learn to feel and express my emotions. I need to be perfect and keep others happy. Can be, I'm not responsible for another's happiness. Some people think the wounds of omission only show up in homes with serious neglect, but it's not true. These wounds are also present in families that look great on the outside, with parents who are executives, clergy, prominent officials, clinicians, or respected leaders. Like a vacuum in our souls, these beliefs keep us fearful, insecure, small, and longing to be loved. The Incredible Shrinking Woman. I'm invisible. Past. Cynthia grew up in a family where no one cared what she felt or thought. When I was really young, I learned my opinions didn't matter. I was invisible. My dad was a well-known cardiologist, a brilliant man who really didn't get kids. My mom was a shell of a person who wore several hats, all monogrammed with my dad's initials on them. Every once in a while, Mom would disagree with Dad and then collapse under his control. Cross him, and he'd cut you off with his wallet or cut you down with his words. I now see how my dad would buy me things to get back at my mom. I didn't feel loved. I felt used. Present. In her marriage, Cynthia struggled to find her own value and voice. When I discovered Chandler was hiding porn, I didn't know what to do. I didn't matter enough for him to stop his porn addiction. Cynthia didn't believe she was lovable and struggled to set boundaries in her marriage. Deep inside, she believed, it doesn't matter what I say. I'm not worth it. When Cynthia thought about confronting Chandler, she was afraid he'd get mad, just like her father. Helping Cynthia work through her fear and change her shame belief to, I am worthy of sexual integrity and a porn-free home, gave her the courage to stand her ground. The emotional seesaw. I'm either too much or not enough. Past. Alexis grew up in a home with a mother who was emotionally entangled with her. Alexis's mom would use her like a surrogate spouse when she was feeling down or lonely. My mom was a single parent who would come home after work, grab a bag of chips, and beg me to watch TV and rub her feet. When I told her I was too tired, she'd get mad or pout. Even though it felt weird, I had a love-hate relationship with her attention. I didn't know how to stop it. When I started going to my friend's house, my mom would get jealous and say, I do everything for you, or we're not as close as we used to be. I felt guilty and angry at the same time. Present. Alexis was shocked to find out about Jeff's affair. When she told Jeff he needed to stop seeing the other woman, he turned it around and made it about her. When I found out about Jeff's affair, I went through the roof. Jeff told me I was too needy, didn't give him enough attention, and never wanted to watch his car races on TV. For months, he tried to make the affair about me and told me I just needed to get over it. I felt enraged and confused. Like a hot potato of blame, Jeff was trying to put the responsibility for his affair back on Alexis. He didn't want to feel the impact of how his affair had hurt her. Eventually, Jeff got into his own recovery and began looking at how he needed to repair his breach of trust rather than blame Alexis for his affair. Alexis discovered it was okay to own her own feelings. I began reading a book by Dr. Ken Adams called Silently Seduced, When Parents Make Their Children Partners. I realize Mom used me to make herself feel better. I spent my life feeling guilty over her unmet emotional needs. I am beginning to look at what emotions are mine and what belongs to Jeff. When I realized I didn't have to take care of Jeff's feelings, I could finally notice what was happening inside of me. I know Jeff wasn't my mom, but it sure felt that way. Both of them blamed me. By putting the pieces together over time, Alexis was able to share her emotions guilt-free. The parked car. I can never make it on my own. Past. Natalie grew up with busy, disconnected parents. My dad owned a car lot, and well, my mom paraded around like a fashion plate of beauty. She had a glass of wine in one hand and credit cards in the other. She filled her days with tennis, shopping, and errands for this or that. I worked in my dad's shop when I needed some quick cash. Brett and I got pregnant at 19 and married. I instantly became a stay-at-home mom. Present. Natalie felt frozen and without options. Financially, she believed her only choice was to stay with a husband who continued to sexually betray her. I'm 62, and both my parents are gone. Brett looks at porn and has had 3 affairs that I know of. I'm too old to get a job, no one will want me, and Brett told me I'd never make it on my own. I believe him. Natalie agreed with Brett and convinced herself right into a corner. She felt trapped. Yes, she hadn't worked since she was 22. The bigger dilemma was Natalie believed that she was incapable and couldn't risk taking financial responsibility for herself. She didn't see any options, so she painfully continued to tolerate the intolerable acts of ongoing infidelity. When Natalie fearlessly came into her own truth, "It's okay to make mistakes, I can do this," she began volunteering and found she had something to offer. Natalie now works full-time at a senior care organization. Her marriage didn't survive, but Natalie reinvented herself and is learning she can do things on her own. Many of us tend to overlook how our wounds of omission impact us. Once we identify them and do our recovery work, it's possible to change how we see things and live our lives differently. Things that shouldn't happen to anyone. Now let's take a look at the wounds of commission. These are the unimaginable deeds that shouldn't happen to anyone. The victim carries the consequences of the inflicted shame, while the perpetrator often behaves shamelessly, using, controlling, and discarding the other. The shame beliefs inherent in the message are disrespect, humiliation, and worthlessness. Some women impacted by sex addiction-induced trauma, sexual violence, or abuse of any kind, physical, emotional, psychological, or financial, can experience feelings of violation when wrongly treated by their spouses. Whether these acts of abuse are rooted in the past or the present, they can leave blank spots, snippets of horror, cryptic memories, or lost periods of time. We might find ourselves feeling closed off, numb, angry, or fearful, or jumping from one thing to another. We long to find rest. See if any of these shame beliefs sound familiar to you. Imagine a graph that says the wounds of commission. These are the things that happen to us that shouldn't happen to anyone. On the left-hand side are the trauma-induced shame beliefs, and on the right-hand side are the healthy positive beliefs. I'm stupid can be, I'm teachable, I can learn. I'm in danger can be, it's over, I can find a safe place now. I'm worthless can be, I'm worthy of respect and honor. I'm not in control can be, I can make choices and decide for myself. I can't trust anyone, can be, I can choose whom to trust. I'm dirty and shameful, can be, I'm worthy of honor. The truth is, I was used. I can't trust my judgment, can be, I've been played. I can learn to trust myself. I'm helpless and can't protect myself, can be, I have choices. I can learn to protect myself. I did something wrong. It's my fault, can be, I did the best I could. I was only a child. More than a body bag, I am enough. Past. Jade's grandfather molested her from the age of 6 into her teens. I begged my mom and told her I didn't want to stay with my grandparents anymore. She didn't ask why. I was too afraid to tell. Sadly, the sexual abuse didn't stop there. I was drugged and raped at a college frat party. I don't know how many men I've had sex with. I've lost count. I just wanted someone to like me. I knew Jared was looking at porn. It bugged me, but I was too afraid to talk with him about it. When I found out about his affair, I heard myself say, "Of course, I've been waiting for this to happen." Present. While Jade knew her husband was looking at pornography, she thought all men looked at porn and never believed Jared would have an affair. I can't trust men. They don't see anything but my breasts and legs, and even those aren't enough. 5 things were true for Jade. 1, she didn't cause the affair. 2, she'd been impacted by earlier sexual abuse. 3, the pain of her husband's sexual betrayal devastated her. 4, it made sense why she felt relationally and sexually guarded. 5, she was able to understand why she was tolerating Jared's pornography use. Jade's shame about her sexual abuse kept her from seeking treatment for years. While she hoped the pain of her grandfather's sexual abuse would go away on its own, she is taking brave steps toward healing her wounds from the past and the present. Jade's marriage is in crisis. While sexual abuse was part of Jade's past, her first priority is to get stabilized from the betrayal trauma with Jared. She's lost trust in men as well as her own ability to trust herself. As Jade focused on her healing and moved into truth, she realized her body was worthy of protection. My mom didn't protect me from my grandfather's sexual abuse. In a strange way, I feel like I've not seen myself either. I was shocked after discovering Jared's affair and realized I need to protect myself. Jade learned how to care for her heart, value her body, and respect herself. The black hole. I'm helpless. Past. Kayla's dad was an alcoholic. He left her family after Kayla was born. As the story goes, my dad didn't want another kid. He would put birth control on my mother's pillow in the morning. My mom shrugged her shoulders and said, "I missed a day. Oh, well." She did her best to deal with him coming home enraged in a drunken stupor most nights. I had 3 older brothers who would bully me. It was everything I could do to make it through the day. Present. Kayla felt overwhelmed by her husband's porn use. I'm helpless over knowing how to make this whole nightmare stop. Not only did Kayla feel overwhelmed by her husband's sex addiction, she grew up feeling helpless too. When I realized I was in the driver's seat of my own life and able to decide what I needed, I found strength I never had before. I couldn't stop my dad's drinking or my brother's bullying, but I can protect myself now. When Kayla replaced the shame belief, "I am helpless," with the truth, "I have choices and can learn to take care of myself," she gave herself permission to come out of a deep freeze and start turning things around. The grass can be greener. We can't change what happened to us, but we can do whatever it takes to heal our wounds from the past. Some of us didn't get what we needed. Some of us had things happen to us that shouldn't happen to anyone. Some of us lived with a combination of both. We've been impacted by dark, stinky dirt. Get my drift? Many of us are in the middle of a dust storm, and our betrayal-induced shame beliefs can take us out. We need to get connected with other women, establish boundaries, and work on replacing our shame beliefs with truth. As much as we'd like to wash the dirt off someone else, we can't. Much like being responsible to take our own shower, each one of us has to wash the dirt, shame, off of ourselves. Digging out from underneath our wounds, whether past or present, becomes the fight for our lives. I lived buried by my shame beliefs for years. Eventually, I had to ask myself one question. Did I want to spend my time cultivating stinky dirt, manure, or work towards growing green grass? When we till the soil and do what's needed to dig into our roots, we can turn those shame beliefs around by planting new seeds of truth. The grass becomes greener when we know the truth about who we are and can distance ourselves from the stinky dirt that covered us. Women come into my office buried in a cesspool of shame and pain. Some women believe those stinking shame beliefs and make agreements with them. I did. I consider myself a T2, trauma squared. Trauma in my family of origin and betrayal trauma in my marriage. I wasted years of my life shaking hands with a dirt farmer. When the dirt comes off and I watch women get a new perspective of themselves, they're unstoppable. I honor women for their incredible wit, W-I-T, whatever it takes tenacity. Transforming their manure into fertilizer over time makes these women even richer. They find their hearts, voices, and passions. They conquer, transform, advocate, love fiercely, and turn the world upside down. They make us turn our heads and say, wow, W-O-W, now that's a woman of worth. We're out there, and we're fighting for you. Chapter 8, Dangerous Liaisons, Understanding Betrayal and Sex Addiction. Standing with a garden hose in one hand and a soapy bucket of water in the other, I watched as Bailey, our freshly bathed yellow lab, rolled his body through the blades of green grass. I loved that dog, especially when he smelled clean. I needed another towel. As I went to get it out of the linen closet, I noticed a bank statement lying open on Connor's desk. A burst of anxiety and a ping of intuition said, "Take a look." Glancing through the numbers, I saw an ATM cash withdrawal for $200. That's strange. What's that for? I zeroed in for more. Then I heard Connor's whistle, a laugh, and rustling at the back door. Bailey darted into the house, his wet paws slipping across the wooden floor. I quickly dropped the statement and walked away from the desk. Why was I feeling guilty? The money came from our bank account. When I think back, the conversation sounded something like this. Connor, hey, I shot bogey in golf today. Bailey looks squeaky clean. Sherry, I responded in a deadpan tone. Yeah, he always loves a good bath. What should I say? I was terrified. How was I going to ask about the $200? My heart was pounding so hard, I could barely hear myself think. So, Connor, I noticed a bank statement on your desk with a $200 cash withdrawal from 6 weeks ago. What was it for? Like a gazelle held in a lion's glare, Connor froze and looked down. He didn't speak a word. I waited. Connor, I took some money out from the account.
Sherry, for what?